when I first started at Olivet, I actually started off as a psychology major. The summer going into Olivet was a time when I was really struggling with a call to ministry. And so by the time we had orientation and I had already registered for my classes for that upcoming year, I'd actually registered as a psychology major. And so I'd signed up for a lot of psychology classes. My senior year in high school, I had a psychology course that was kind of it was a different course. I had to have it through TV. It was something that was broadcast in. I was the only one in the class, and so I had to mail my homework in and that sort of a thing. It was a different situation. But it was a really interesting class. It was something that caught my curiosity. And so when I registered for all of that, I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to do something in the area of psychology, counseling, that sort of thing. So, like I said, for that first year at Olivet, I actually had four or five different psychology courses that I was registered for. And one of the classes that was particularly helpful was a class called History and Systems of Psychology. And so that was something that gave you a broad look at psychology and the different kinds of work that had been done by different psychologists, like obviously Sigmund Freud, he had his own work, and Adler, kind of a behavior kind of thing. So you had all these different people, and you kind of learned, got a little glimpse of everything as you went through that course. As a part of that course, too, they had a book report that you had to do. There was a list of books, a prescribed list, and you had to pick a book off that list and write a paper on it. So as I was going through and trying to decide what book to choose, there was one in particular that had to do with concentration camps, a guy by the name of Viktor Frankl. And as I've mentioned before, I have a curiosity about the World War II era, the Depression era, that sort of a thing. And so when I saw, okay, this is by somebody about that time period, I think that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to read his book. And it was very, very informative and very helpful in a lot of ways. So I ended up picking up the book. The book was called Man's Search for Meaning. And Viktor was somebody who developed his methods about psychology and treatment and counseling following his experiences as a concentration camp survivor. So he lived in, he was actually in Auschwitz and a few other camps. And following his experiences, he worked on basically what was called logotherapy. And a word that is woven all the way throughout this book in particular and his work as a whole is the word hope. Hope was instrumental in people's ability to survive the horrors of a concentration camp. Those who had hope and those who were able to hold on to hope were able to survive. The people who lost their grip on hope and gave in to despair, they did not. For those who would survive, hope was not something found inside the fences and walls of their particular circumstances. It was not something found in the camp. Hope was not something in their proximity. There was nothing hopeful about what was surrounding them in those camps. There was also nothing particularly hopeful about their present. There was nothing in their present situation to be happy about going from day to day. Hope was something that was connected to the future. Hope was something that was coming. And because the things that these hopeful survivors hoped for was not something found in the camp, and it was something wasn't something that was in their immediate situation, hope for them was, for the most part, something unseen. Many times what kept these people living was the hope of seeing a loved one again, spouse, children, parents, friends. While their hope was directed at something in the future, their being set free, and while their hope was directed at people they hoped to see again, their loved ones, that powerful hope gave them strength and purpose, to these future survivors right where they were in the middle of a horrific camp situation. Viktor's work and the understanding that he provides about survivors could easily be described as the psychology of hope. As I shifted from that first year going from a psychology major, and I had already registered for the next year and a lot of classes in religion, one of the things that I was very excited to see was getting acquainted with a guy by the name of Jürgen Moltmann, an author, somebody who also had different experiences as far as concentration camps and the horrors that happened there. He's a theologian, and he's written a lot of different things, but one of the books that he wrote is called The Theology of Hope. To summarize that work, God in Christ suffers with humanity while also promising humanity a better future through the hope of the resurrection. What amazed me back in college and was really helpful for me was seeing two people who went through some horrible circumstances, but the thing that they came out of those experiences talking about was something like hope. Who can look at a concentration camp experience and see hope? Who can look at Jesus bloodied and dying on a cross and see hope? Last week, we spent our time looking at the life of Abraham and Sarah as they waited for God to fulfill his promise of an heir, a son. In the process, we saw the challenges that they faced as the very visible issue of their old age made hope hard to hold on to. We saw them lose patience with God because they were in a hurry, and in their hurry, they developed an alternative path to a fulfilled promise through the union of Abraham and Hagar. But God did not bless their plan and the work of their hands because the promise must be fulfilled by the one who made the promise. God keeps his promises, and he kept his promises, his promise to Abraham and Sarah when, after many years, along came Isaac. Go ahead and turn to 2 Kings chapter 6. This is where we're going to continue our look into hope. 2 Kings chapter 6. We're going to be looking at the man of God named Elisha. This is following the departure of Elijah. Elisha becomes the one who the people of Israel turn to for wisdom and help, guidance. And Elisha's guidance is something that's actually very successful and helpful for the people of Israel. 2 Kings chapter 6, we're going to read verses 8 through 23. Now the king of Aram was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, "I will set up my camp in such and such a place." The man of God, Elisha, sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware of passing that place because the Arameans are going down there." So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. This enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, "Will you not tell me which of us is on the side of the king of Israel?" "None of us, my lord and king," said one of his officers. "But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in the bedroom, in your bedroom." "Go find out where he is," the king ordered, "so I can send men and capture him." The report came back, "He is in Dothan." Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. They went by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots surrounded the city. "Oh, my lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. "Don't be afraid," the prophet answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "O Lord, open his eyes so he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. As the enemy came down toward him, Elisha prayed to the Lord, "Strike these people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. Elisha told them, "This is not the road, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will lead you to the man who you are looking for." And he led them to Samaria. After they entered the city, Elisha said, "Lord, open the eyes of these men so they can see." Then the Lord opened their eyes, and they looked, and there they were, inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he asked Elisha, "Shall I kill them, my father? Shall I kill them?" "Do not kill them," he answered. "Would you kill men you have captured with your own sword or bow? Set food and water before them so that they may eat and drink and then go back to their master." So he prepared a great feast for them, and after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them away, and they returned to their master. So the bands from Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory. What would your response be if you were in Elisha's sandals? He didn't have runny shoes like some of us may have. Sandals aren't the most comfortable things to try and run in. But what would you do if you were in Elisha's sandals? A friend tells you news that doesn't sound very promising. You look out and you see an army coming to capture you, and that doesn't look very promising either. What I want to point out in this story are a few things that we actually don't see happening in this story. The first thing is we don't see Elisha panic. Elisha is trapped by an army, but his response is not one of surrender or defeat. It's also not one of panic. We don't see him frantically trying to find a way to sneak out of the town or hide in a secret spot in the town. His hope and his confidence is in God, and it isn't swayed by the sudden changing of his circumstances. We also don't see Elisha influenced by the fear of his servant. I don't know what stresses you out, but I do know one thing that stresses me out, and that is people that are stressed out. Being around stressed out people has an effect on me. Stress has a way of being contagious. Have you ever had that happen with fear? Maybe you were dealing with a very difficult situation, and while you're dealing with it, you're actually dealing with a situation very fine, no problems, you're coping well, and then a fear-filled person has a conversation with you, and their words are something like this: wow, I don't know how you are dealing with that as well as you are. If it were me, I'd be worried about this and this and this and this. Fear has a way that can be contagious. And so in a situation like that, you might end up finding yourself thinking, wow, I really should be stressed about this and this and this and this. A fear-filled person is bringing a fearful situation to the attention of Elisha, but Elijah doesn't seem interested in joining the servant on the fear train. What we also don't see in this story is we don't see what Elisha sees. As we read along in the story from the point of view of the king of Aram sending an army all the way up until the point where Elisha is notified by his servant, we don't see the fact that God's got an army protecting Elijah this whole time. What is unseen to us, what is unseen to the servant, what is unseen to the army that is sent to capture him, all of that is somehow seen by Elijah. He is able to see the unseen, and his answered prayer allows the servant to also see the unseen. We don't see him panic. We don't see him fearful. We don't see what Elisha saw. There's a saying that maybe you've heard before, something I've heard different times before, and hopefully you can read it. I'll go ahead and read it. It says, watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become your character. And watch your character, they become your destiny. Like I said, this isn't a new saying. This is something I've heard at different times, and maybe you've even heard it in the context of a sermon. What I want to talk about this morning, though, is actually the thing before the thing. It's the thing that comes before all of this. It's the things that affect our thoughts. Our thoughts aren't something that happen just randomly. Our thoughts are affected by the things around us. And so that's what I want to talk about this morning, are the things that make our thoughts turn to something that's hopeless or despair. Throughout the course of your day, there are many thoughts that are triggered by external things that are completely out of your control. Our thoughts are many times a response to one of two things, what we see and what we hear. In the same way that the context of our faith matters, the context of our hope matters as well. Things like fear, worry, and doubt can have a crippling effect on our faith, as we talked about in the first 2 weeks of this series. And now, as we talk about hope, it is important for us to realize how the things that we see with our human eyes and hear with our human ears can have a crippling effect on the hopes that we have and the thoughts that we have. What we see can kill our hopes. Going back to the concentration camp situation I started with, as a prisoner in such an inhumane situation, it would be very easy to spend the day dwelling on each and every negative aspect of camp life, from the inadequate food to the inadequate clothing to the forced labor to the poor sleeping situation. The entire day from beginning to end could be filled with despair. However, that mindset and that focus leads to much more than just despair. It can lead to death. Those that survived had the ability to see past the clearly visible and were able to see the unseen. They could imagine the joy of being reunited with loved ones. They could imagine starting life over again. And those thoughts kept them from giving up, giving in. They remained hopeful that something good was coming. Go ahead and turn to Romans chapter 8. I'm going to do some read from there. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, we're going to start in verse 22. We're going to read 22 through 25. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved, but hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what he already has? But we hope for what we do not have. We wait for it patiently. Admittedly, I'm not the least bit qualified to talk about something like childbirth, so I will ask for a little bit of grace and mercy as I attempt to do just that. Long before you see a baby, long before you even see a baby bump, there are things that serve as indicators that a baby is coming. From a missed cycle to a sudden craving for pickles and ice cream, a woman can become keenly aware that something has changed. You can't see anything on the surface with the human eye, but deep down you can feel it. What Paul is saying by describing our world, all of creation, in terms of a woman ready to give birth, is that even though we can't see the fulfilled promise of a new heaven and a new earth, we know it's coming. Everything is pointing to the fact that God's kingdom is going to break into this world that is so full of death and fill it with new and abundant and everlasting life. While God's kingdom may not be seen on the surface, hope-filled eyes that can see the unseen know that it's coming. And as Paul says, we wait for it patiently. How do we know that God's kingdom is breaking into this world? A few weeks ago on a Wednesday night, Edna brought a container of strawberries from her garden for Lori and I. If you're jealous, I don't mind. They were delicious. When Edna handed them off to Lori, she referred to them as the first fruits from her garden. If you're not familiar with what is meant by first fruits, it's not really that complicated of a thing. When it came to giving offerings to God, people would sacrificially give what was ripe and ready first as a sign of trust that God wasn't done blessing the harvest. Rather than waiting to see at the end of the harvest season how good of an abundant year it might have been, they would give at the beginning of the year with the hopeful expectation that God wasn't done yet. In Romans 8, verse 23, Paul says that you and I have the first fruits of the Spirit. What does Paul mean by that? Let me go back to the question I asked just a little bit ago. How do we know that God is breaking into this world right now as it pertains to God's promise of a new heaven and a new earth? How do we know that God's kingdom is breaking into this world right now? Because we have already seen God's kingdom break into our very own lives. We have already seen God breathe new life into our own lives. We have already seen God's redeeming power in our own lives. We have already seen God's love soften our hardened hearts. And that work of the Spirit within us is only the first fruits of what God is going to do. God's work inside of us is only the beginning, a glimpse, a foretaste of what is to come. We can be hopeful about God's kingdom breaking into this broken world in the future because we have already seen God's kingdom at work in our own broken lives right now. Our thoughts can remain hopeful when we refuse to let the visible brokenness dominate our attention and our thoughts. And we can remain hopeful about our world because of what we see God doing in us. The words we hear can kill our hopes. I'm sure that you're all very familiar with the phrase, finding a needle in a haystack. While finding a needle in a haystack may seem like an impossible task, there is another task that is even more challenging. And that task is finding a needle in a haystack while surrounded by a group of people pointing out each piece of hay. With each piece of hay that they point to, you find your attention drawn away, and you're looking drawn away from what you are looking for, the needle, and instead drawn to the thing you're not looking for, which is more hay. Imagine your frustration level growing as you are looking for a needle, but everyone else around you is pointing to the straw. If you were all looking for the needle, your odds of finding it would obviously go up dramatically. But no, you're there looking for a needle, surrounded by people talking about the straw. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, there's a phrase that I want to reword a little bit to use for this discussion on hope. In chapter 15, verse 13, it says, "Do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character." And here's what I'd like to propose this morning as we talk about hope. Bad attitudes corrupt good vision. If you are the kind of person who is trying to find hope in a situation, but you are surrounded by people who have ultimately given up hope or are on the path to giving up hope, your vision will be greatly hindered because of those people. Let's go back to the screen that we looked at earlier as far as thoughts, words, actions, habits, character, and destiny. If you're trying to maintain a hopeful mindset about a situation, but you're surrounded by people whose language isn't hopeful, whose actions aren't hopeful, whose habits aren't hopeful, how long do you think you can last before you start thinking like they do, talking like they do, or acting like they do? On the flip side, how much easier would it be for you to have hope-filled thoughts if you were surrounded by people who spoke hope-filled words and acted in hope-filled ways? If you hang out with people that are already on the way, already on the path towards a hopeless situation or despair, you're going to join on that path with them. As I said earlier, the context of your hope matters, and the people that have regular access and a regular voice into your ears can have a direct impact on your ability to find and hold on to hope. It's one thing to express fears and concerns, but if that's the only thing that you're expressing, that's a problem. As I said last week, followers of Christ ought to be the most hope-filled people in the world. Ought to be. Are your words, are our words, overflowing with hope? On Friday night, during our game night, I played Jenga with Lori and Edna. And I think that Edna can vouch for the fact that I like taking a lot of risks during that game. I would take some of the more complicated pieces, like, I'm going to tackle that one. I'm going to play risky with this. I'm naturally a bit of a risk taker. And so when it comes to being the interim guy, there's also the temptation to take risks, ask some of the maybe tougher questions. When it comes to Calvary, when it comes to this church that we're in here right now, are you one of the? Are your one-on-one conversations overflowing with hope, or are they bogged down with fears? I don't know where your conversations fall on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being despair about Calvary, or 10 being optimistic about Calvary, but I can tell you this. If you want to see someone go from a 10 to a 9 to an 8, all you need to do is surround them with people who are at a 1 and a 2. If you want to see someone who is at a 2 or a 3, or at a 2, go up to a 3, or go up to a 4, or even to a 5. Surround them with people who are at an 8, a 9, or a 10. When Elisha receives news from his fearful servant, he says a prayer for him. He prays for him to have eyes to see what he sees. Elisha's hope and Elisha's confidence is in God, and his confidence and hope is at a 10. And what he wants is for the servant to have the same kind of hope and confidence in God and be at a 10 as well. Be careful and be prayerful about the people you surround yourself with. Your hope may depend on your ability to deal with people who fail to see anything other than the negative and who fail to say anything other than gloom and doom. As we conclude this morning's service, I do have to ask, how hopeful of a person are you? Over the course of 2 weeks, we've seen God deliver on his promise to Abraham and Sarah, and we've seen God deliver Elisha from a massive army sent to capture him. God delivers on his promises, and his promise to you and to me is the promise of a world made new. And while it may be a challenge to see it, maybe you've already gotten a glimpse of what God has begun to do through his work inside of you. As we sing, the altar is going to be open. If you want to come and pray, maybe something you need this morning is help with your vision. Maybe your prayer is, Lord, help me to see what you see. Maybe there are situations where it's tough to see God at work. Maybe you see the army that is sent by the king of Aram that is sent against you, but you don't see God's army that's on sent to protect you, that's on your behalf. Go ahead and stand, and we're going to close in a song, and then we'll pray.